Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 166 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And this is in this episode, I'll be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. And this one is going to be focused on psychiatry. I don't know, for whatever reason, psych is now becoming quite relevant. Let me just put it that way, for lack of a better term. It's becoming quite relevant on the USMLE exams. So that's something you absolutely want to become a monster at, especially like the psych drugs. But I'm going to talk about a lot of psych. In fact, I'll probably make a full-up podcast to this, because there's a lot of like high yield stuff I really want to put out there with a psychiatry. So let's just jump right into it. So this is rapid review series 20, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, so what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that feels that he's the president of the United States and feels that, you know, I don't know, like maybe like a famous person. He's his executive assistant, and this person has only slept for like an hour every day for the past 2 weeks, and this person really doesn't have any need for food, and they kind of feel like Superman. What's your diagnosis there? Well, I would hope you're saying that the person has a bipolar disorder, right? So bipolar disorder, right? I mean, like literally the word bipolar means two poles, right? So that means those people are on two ends of the spectrum, right? So they have like these manic episodes, right? Which is typically characterized by the presence of dig-fast symptoms, right? So they have manic episodes characterized by dig-fast symptoms. So like distractibility, they're irritable. They have like these grandiose ideas. They have like these flight of ideas. They have like this rapid speech. They are talkative and things of that nature, right? They have a decreased need for sleep. Those are all things that go ahead with mania, right? So, you know, they tend to have like mania, and then they have, so that's one pole, right? And then the second pole that makes it bipolar, right? Two polar, right? The second thing that makes up that is having depressive episodes, right? So whenever you see that, think about bipolar disorder. And the thing is, you don't need to have both ends of the spectrum to make a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. If a person has manic episodes, that's more than fine. That more than cuts it for the diagnosis of a bipolar disorder, right? And remember that those people need to have symptoms for at least more than a week, okay, for you to say that they have bipolar disorder. But there's a weird exception to that rule. The weird exception to that rule is if they have social dysfunction, like significant social dysfunction, or they need to be hospitalized, then all bets are off. The 1 week rule does not apply anymore. Under those circumstances, they still have bipolar disorder. Now, what is the drug of choice for treating bipolar disorder? Well, I would hope you're telling me lithium, right? Remember, lithium is the drug of choice for treating bipolar disorder. Remember that it is actually kind of high yield to know for exams that lithium is one of two drugs in psychiatry that has been shown to decrease the risk of suicide. What is the other drug? I'll give you some hints. This other drug can cause like a neutropenic fever. This drug can cause myocarditis, so it can present as a dilated cardiomyopathy on MEME exams. And this drug can also cause hypersalivation. What is the drug? Well, I would hope you're telling me clozapine. Remember, clozapine is an atypical antipsychotic. Basically, it's the most effective antipsychotic of all. It's even more effective than haloperidol. You may say, Divine, that's not true. I will encourage you to do your own research and look it up, right? So lithium, right? It decreases the risk of suicide. It's the drug of choice for bipolar disorder, right? But the thing is, lithium, your friends at the MBME, they love to test it in the context of many of its unique side effects, right? So one is hypothyroidism, right? So typically, before you start a patient on lithium, you try to get like a baseline TSH to kind of see where they're hanging out. And then another important thing with lithium is that lithium can also cause an nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, right? So they may give you an MBME question, and obviously they'll give you labs, right? And likely the person will have like a high serum osmolarity and a low urine osmolarity. You'll be like, man, this person's sodium is like 149, but their urine osmolarity is like 200, right? If you see that, think about lithium, right? With a nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, right? So if you're going back to renal from step one, remember that in the distal nephron, we have like the principal cell, and that principal cell has an INEC channel, right? And that INEC channel, remember that if you go back to college chemistry, lithium is element 3 in the periodic table, and sodium is element 11 in the periodic table, right? So they're both in group 1, right? So it's like, if you're going with the valency or whatever, I'll leave that to the people I tutor for the MCAT. But basically, lithium is in group 1, sodium is in group 1. So because they're both in group 1, right, they have similar chemical properties. So because they have similar chemical properties, and they actually have a fairly similar size, if sodium can use that INEC channel at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct, you bet that lithium can do the same thing, right? So lithium can do the same thing. So because lithium can do the same thing, it can get in through that INEC channel and scrub the second messenger cascade of ADH, right? So that's the mechanism behind lithium causing a nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. So the thing is, if you already know that lithium causes a nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, well, and you know that it gains entry to that principal cell of the collecting duct through the innate channel, right? Then it then stands to reason that you would want to ideally block that innate channel as a means of treating the nephrogenic diabetes insipidus that is associated with lithium use, right? So those innate channel blockers, your key-sparing diuretics like amiloride and triamterene, those are the drugs of choice for treating the nephrogenic diabetes insipidus that's associated with lithium use. They'll try to trick you on the exam and give you like hydrochlorothiazide, because in general, when a person has nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, hydrochlorothiazide is actually the drug of choice for treating nephrogenic DI, right? But the thing is, there's an exception to that rule. And that rule is when a person has nephrogenic DI from lithium use. When a person has nephrogenic DI from lithium use, then you absolutely positively do not want to use a thiazide. If you use a thiazide, you will actually increase the person's risk of lithium toxicity, right? Because in general, anything that increases the activity of the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system will worsen a person's lithium toxicity. So say, for example, if a person is volume down, right? If you're volume down, your renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system will be upregulated. You will have more activity of aldosterone. So that innate channel, remember aldosterone. I mean, there is more stuff there, but again, this is a rapid review podcast, so I'm not going to go into a ton of extraneous detail. I mean, it's not extraneous, especially for step one, but I think for step two CK purposes, this should do. But basically, right, if you're volume down, the activity of your renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system increases. And one of the things aldosterone does is that it increases the activity of that innate channel that you find at the principal cell of the collecting duct. So the thing that happens is when a person has is volume down, right, and that innate channel is working better, yes, you're reabsorbing more sodium, but you're also reabsorbing a ton of lithium, because again, lithium uses that same innate channel to get back into the nephron, right? So if a person takes HCTZ, right, HCTZ will dry you out, it will make you volume down because it's a diuretic, right? Now rev up your renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, and that is not awesome if a person has lithium toxicity in the form of nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. And hopefully you remember that demeclocycline, remember that's a tetracycline, so it's like a bacteriostatic 30S inhibitor. That's another drug that can also cause a nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. In fact, we take advantage of that. For example, maybe you have like a patient on the exam that has like small cell lung cancer, right? And you have like SIDH as one of the paraneoplastic phenomena. One thing you can do is, I mean, obviously you do fluid restriction, or you can give an ADH receptor antagonist, right? So like your conivaptan or tolvaptan. But really, another thing you can also consider doing is to give them demeclocycline, which is a tetracycline, but it has nephrogenic diabetes insipidus as a side effect. So you kind of take advantage of that in treating a SIDH. Now, so I've talked about the hypothyroidism that's associated with lithium use. I've talked about the nephrogenic diabetes insipidus that is associated with lithium use. Another thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with lithium is that it causes tremors. Okay, so lithium causes tremors. That's probably one of the most common side effects of lithium. And then another key thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with lithium is its teratogenicity, right? So lithium is a teratogen, right? Lithium can cause Epstein's anomaly, right? So you essentially have like a downward displacement of the tricuspid valve, right? So the boss phrase you want to recognize on exams is something known as the atrialization of the right ventricle. Okay, so lithium can cause Epstein's anomaly under those circumstances. Although on MBME exams, if you get a question about a lady that is on lithium, okay, and she has bipolar disorder and it's been well controlled, right, and she gets pregnant, you don't really need to stop lithium. But if, for example, you discover a person has bipolar disorder in pregnancy, now these days the drug of choice for bipolar disorder in pregnancy is actually haloperidol. Okay, it's haloperidol, or you can use any other kind of antipsychotic. Okay, now one weird scenario I kind of want to introduce you to is, because again, they've started doing this again on the new USMLE Step 2 CK exam. Basically, if you ever see me say the new USMLE Step 2 CK exam, just essentially imagine the USMLE exam that essentially like was introduced like 3-4 months ago. So the thing is, when a person has bipolar disorder, I just said that the drug of choice is lithium. That is absolutely true. But the thing is, if a person is acutely manic, you can't give them lithium and hope for the best and wait for them to snap out of that manic state. So when a person is acutely manic, your drug of choice is actually an antipsychotic. Okay, your drug of choice is actually an antipsychotic, and then you start them on lithium at the same time to sort of like get them, right, get them like therapeutic so that you can get them into chronic management of their bipolar disorder. And then another classic scenario you may see on MBME exams is they may give you a question about a patient that has bipolar disorder, right, and then they tell you that, oh, the person has been on lithium, doesn't appear to be controlling their symptoms properly, and then they ask for your next best step in management. One thing you can do is you can continue the lithium, but you also add on an antipsychotic. It's almost always an atypical antipsychotic that you add on the MBME exam. So again, that's a very high yield thing to keep at the back of your mind for tests. And then lithium I think that those are kind of like the big things I think I want to mention with lithium. I've talked about how it decreases the risk of suicide. Okay, now what if they give you a question and the essentially I'm just going to do like a free-for-all because I want to do an head over somewhere real quick. So if they give you a question about a patient and this patient has hypertension and they're taking some kind of psych drug, what drug are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about the SNRIs, right? Remember, the SNRI is like venlafaxine, right? Venlafaxine, the SNRI is almost as a drug class, right? They tend to cause hypertension. And venlafaxine is the poster child one because, I mean, yeah, there's other SNRIs, but they don't typically test those in the context of hypertension, right? So your other SNRIs like duloxetine or milnacipran. Duloxetine, for the most part, is used to treat like neuropathic pain. So especially like in people that have like a history of diabetes. And then milnacipran is used to treat fibromyalgia on MBME exams, okay? But if you see hypertension, psych med, think about venlafaxine. And then what if they give you a question about a patient that is now having low libido and they recently started a psych med, right? I would hope under those circumstances you're thinking about things like your SSRIs and your SNRIs, right? So remember, your SSRIs are things like fluoxetine, sertraline, citalopram, escitalopram, fluvoxamine. Those are your big timer SSRIs, right? And again, remember, right, your SSRIs, their classic side effects, sexual dysfunction like low libido, although you can actually take advantage of that by essentially, if a person has like premature ejaculation, right? So let's say, you know, a guy gets too excited, you know, he gets excited like pretty quickly. So it's like, oh, once he starts within like 3 minutes, he's willing to, you know, release that stuff, right? So if a person has premature ejaculation, the drug of choice in that situation is actually an SSRI, because you're essentially taking advantage of the sexual dysfunction to kind of restrain the person as sexually, right? So that's the drug of choice for treating a premature ejaculation. And then remember that your SSRIs, they can also cause weight gain, right? Your SSRIs can cause weight gain, they can cause sexual dysfunction. And remember that you can actually use them on MBME exams to treat PMDD, right? So like premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Essentially, the way PMDD presents on MBME exams, they will talk about a woman that around the time of her menses, she just has like just terrible symptoms, like really bad, like depression, yada, yada, yada. If you see that, think about a PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. The drugs of choice for treating those are your SSRIs. So again, that's something high yield to know for exams. And then remember, your SSRIs are also the drugs of choice for treating generalized anxiety disorder, right? Although for GAD, a second line medication you may consider using is buspirone, right? Buspirone. Remember, buspirone is a partial agonist at serotonin 5-HT2A receptors, okay? So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. And remember that generalized anxiety disorder, you need to have symptoms for 6 months for you to say that a person has generalized anxiety disorder, right? And your SSRIs are also used to treat major depressive disorder, right? And again, major depressive disorder, remember your CGCAP symptoms, right, for more than 2 weeks, right? You need to have 5 out of 9 of those CGCAP symptoms, right? So what does CGCAP stand for, right? So the S is for sleep, right? The I is for loss of interest, the G is for guilt, the E is for low energy, the C is for poor concentration, the A is for issues with appetite, the P is for like psychomotor retardation, the S is for suicidal ideation. So you may say, Devon, you just said 5 out of 9, right? And CGCAP is an 8-letter word. Well, the other thing is a low mood. Low mood is 9, okay? So you need 5 out of 9 CGCAP symptoms for 2 weeks or more, okay? For 2 weeks or more. If you get an MBME exam question and a person seems to have like many of the symptoms of MDD, but they don't have up to 5 out of 9 of those CGCAP symptoms, or they have like the 5 or more out of 9, but they don't meet the time frame, right? And then they tell you that the person had like a recent stressor, like family member was recently diagnosed with a bad disease, or the person recently broke up with their girlfriend, yada, 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 then the answer you want to pick is not major depressive disorder. The answer you want to pick is adjustment disorder with depressed mood, okay? That is what you should go after on MBME exams. Adjustment disorder is just something that is floridly high yield these days for the USMLE exams. So that is something I'm going to talk about in the next, probably one of the next rapid review podcasts. Like I said, I'm going to make a second part to this because, again, psychiatry has been making a big showing on the new USMLE exam. So I think that's something I'm going to kind of like zone in on over the next 2 or 3 podcasts. I mean, amongst the other podcasts I'm going to try to make as well. And then remember, your SSRIs are also the first line for treating PTSD, right? So PTSD in general responds pretty well to SSRIs. Remember, PTSD, those people have like flashbacks, and it will typically be like a person like in the military or something weird like that. And they have like, you know, had like a really bad, pretty terrible like life experience, like their mates were killed in war or something like that, and then they keep having flashbacks. They have symptoms for more than a month, right? That's PTSD. Remember, if they have symptoms for less than a month, It's called acute stress disorder, right? So the first line medication for treating PTSD is an SSRI. Although if they give you an exam question and a person that has a history of PTSD is having like a lot of nightmares, the drug of choice for that situation is actually prazosin, okay? Prazosin. Prazosin is an alpha-1 antagonist and it's the drug of choice for that scenario. And I mean, as a quick sidebar here, right? Again, PTSD, we obviously know that it's a lot of veterans that suffer from this condition. Again, just whenever you see a vet, right, kind of respect their effort, right? It's not easy to go to a different country and defend this country, right? So just be a, you know, the veterans, we really do appreciate your service. So, you know, just whenever you can help them out, just help them. At least that's one of philosophy I've always had. I always try to help people in the military whenever possible, because again, it's not the easiest job in the world. So, okay, so back to this, right? So now, what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that's taking a psych med and the person gets seizures? And let's say this person, you know, took this med and they have anorexia nervosa and then they got seizures. Well, what drug are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about bupropion, right? Remember, bupropion is an antidepressant and it's an NDRI. It's a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor, okay? It's a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor. Remember that bupropion, it's kind of unusual with regards to the other antidepressants in the sense that it does not have sexual side effects, okay? So they can give you an NBME question about a patient that is having like bad sexual side effects from a like an SSRI or an SNRI. Under those circumstances, you can actually add bupropion to their medication regimen, or you can substitute their SSRI for bupropion, right? And then remember that bupropion is actually helpful for weight loss. Okay, bupropion is helpful for weight loss. And then one other thing that bupropion is also helpful for is smoking cessation. Okay, although it is not the most effective therapy for smoking cessation. The most effective therapy for smoking cessation is varenicline. Okay, varenicline is a partial agonist at nicotine receptors. Okay, so it's really good for smoking cessation. Although if you add varenicline to like a nicotine patch, both together work better than using either separately. Okay, or if you add like a nicotine patch to bupropion, both work together better than each being used separately. So that's a high yield thing to keep at the back of your mind for the USMLE exams. And then another thing with bupropion, right, is that it lowers the seizure threshold, right? So if a person has like history of seizure disorder, you don't want to give them bupropion. Or if they have some kind of disorder that predisposes them to seizures, for example, if they have like anorexia nervosa, right? Remember, people that are anorexic or people that are bulimic or people that have like binge eating, let's say more people that are anorexic or people that are bulimic, you'll see why I want to make those fine distinctions in a second. But people that have anorexia or bulimia, right, they vomit a ton, right? So those people, they will be hypochloremic, right? And because they're vomiting a ton, they will also be volume down, right? So the renin angiotensin aldosterone system will be all spruced up, right? So those people will have hypokalemia, right? They'll have hypokalemia. They'll have a metabolic alkalosis because, again, if your aldosterone is very high, right, that will increase the activity of that proton pump that you find at the level of the alpha intercalated cell of the distal nephron, right? So those people tend to get a metabolic alkalosis, right? And then they will also have hyponatremia. So some people will say, Divine, that doesn't make sense. If you're volume down, should you not be hypernatremic? That is actually not true. The only time, and again, I will hopefully explain this in a different podcast in the future, but the only time you can ever be volume down, at least for purposes of the NBME, and be hypernatremic is if you have diabetes insipidus. Whenever ADH is working as it should, you will never be hypernatremic. Even in the real world, it's highly unusual to be hypernatremic when your ADH mechanism is checking out as it should, right? So in general, when a person is volume down, they will almost always be hyponatremic. Because again, when you're volume down, you rev up your renin angiotensin aldosterone system. Aldosterone helps you reabsorb sodium and water, but ADH helps you reabsorb free water. Okay, so you have two things that are promoting water reabsorption and one thing that is promoting sodium reabsorption. So you ultimately become hyponatremic when you're volume down. Okay, and then, I mean, obviously, if you're vomiting, right, like your levels of all your salivary enzymes, right, they will have like increased levels in your serum as well. Okay, that is why if a person has pancreatitis, right, that's why you typically, you know, go out more with like lipase, because lipase is a little more sensitive because it only comes from the pancreas. Contrast that with amylase that is found both in the pancreas and in the salivary glands. Okay, so that's something high yield you want to keep at the back of your mind. So I said that I wanted to make this distinction between like anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and a disorder known as binge eating disorder, right? Again, that's something that your friends at the MBME are beginning to show like pretty good interest in on the New Year's MLE exams. So the thing is, anorexia nervosa, right? Again, it will be a person that, you know, vomits, exercises a crap ton. The key thing you're looking for on tests is that those people will have a low weight, okay? Their weight will not be normal. Their BMI will be, I think, less than 18.5. Okay, if a person has normal weight, that excludes the diagnosis of anorexia nervosa on an MBME exam. And then bulimia nervosa, right? Again, those people, you know, they eat a ton, they vomit, they eat a ton, they vomit, or they eat a ton and they compensate, right? The thing is, if you have a person that eats a ton, that binge eats and has a compensatory behavior, that is bulimia nervosa, okay? But if you have a person that binge eats and does not have compensatory behavior, that is binge eating disorder. That is the key critical difference between bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder on MBME exams. So I think I'm kind of like at the point where I have to run. So I think I'll go ahead and end this podcast now. I'm going to make another one. I have a lot of stuff in my brain I really want to pour out in podcasts. I feel like this one week I kind of didn't make podcasts. My brain is just kind of chock full of stuff. So I need to go ahead and sort of like release a lot of that information. So hopefully over the next few days, I'm going to crank out a ton of podcasts. So as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams. Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 2 CS, Step 3, preclinical med school exams, third-year clerkship shelf exams. And then I do this thing called longitudinal tutoring, right? Where I, if you're a first, second, or third year medical student, I tutor you for like your class exams or your shelf exams. But at the same time, I tutor you for your upcoming USMLE exam. And most of the people I've done this with, they've been like wildly successful on these USMLEs. So if that's something you're interested in, feel free to reach out to me. You can either reach out to me through the website or send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com. Okay, and then if you're a medicine resident, I tutor for the internal medicine in training exam. I also tutor for the internal medicine ABIM board exam, right? And then if you're a college student, I tutor for like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, Physiology. I tutor for all those things. I also tutor for the MCAT as well. And then if you need like coaching or advising with your application, right? So like if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, I do offer like one-on-one advising. So like personal statements, rec letters, editing applications, mock interviews. That's something I'm probably doing more than my fair share of these days. That's something I also offer coaching for and advice in. Again, I've worked with hundreds and hundreds of people, and again, most of the people I've worked with, they've matched their first choices. And I also have admissions committee experience, so I've read like thousands and thousands of very high quality applications. So if that's something you're interested in, feel free to reach out to me. And then the last thing I offer is this thing I call a booster course, right? So if for step one and for step one is 20 hours, for step two CK and step three it's 10 hours. And essentially, if you're at the end of your dedicated period, or you're like a week out from your exam, or you know, you feel like your knowledge base is good and you want to kind of like put everything together in a high yield format, I do offer that. It's a Q&A course spread out over like 2 or 3 days. And again, we'll review like most of the high yield content from like the different disciplines tested on the respective USMLE exam that you're preparing for. So that, again, if that's something you're interested in, feel free to reach out to me. And yes, for step two CK, step three, it's a 10 hour course. But if you want me to extend it to even 20 hours for you, right, you can always let me know. Again, I feel like 10 hours is good, right? But there are some people I've done these courses with that is run like 20 hours, 25 hours. If they want it to be like, oh, like super, super, like that's probably going more into the realm of like something like relatively more comprehensive than a 10-hour course. Okay. So if you're interested in any of that, feel free to reach out to me. So I wish you a wonderful rest of your day. I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.